flushed. "Well, this is a surprise," I say, slurring a little.
"Really?"
Alec says.
"With how you were plying Bernard with alcohol, I thought this was part of some evil plan."
"Is he passed out?" I ask.
"Snoring so fucking loud," Alec says, and as we both start to laugh, he presses his forefinger to my lips.
"Shh," he warns.
"I've tried to sneak over here the last two nights, and he woke up and came out of his bedroom before I even made it to the door. I thought about taking up smoking just so I could have an ironclad excuse."
More laughter bubbles through me, warming my insides, fizzing through them. "Do you really think he would have followed you over?" I whisper, his fingers still pressed to my lips.
"I wasn't willing to take that chance."
On the other side of the wall, we hear a wretched snore, and I start giggling so hard my legs go watery and I sink to the floor. Alex does too. We fall into a heap, a tangle of limbs and silent, quaking laughter. I smack futilely at his arm as another horrible thunder roll snore roars through the wall.
"I've missed you,"
Alex says through a grin as the laughter's subsiding.
"Me too,"
I say, cheeks aching. He brushes the hair out of my face, static making a few strands dance around his hand.
"But at least now I have three of you."
I grip his wrist to steady myself and close one eye to see him better.
"Too many wine?"
he teases, slipping his hand around my neck.
"Nah," I say. "Just enough to knock out Bernard. The perfect amount."
My head is pleasantly swimming, and my skin feels warm beneath Alex's hand, rings of satisfying heat reverberating out from it all the way to my toes.
"This must be how it feels to be a cat," I hum.
He laughs.
"How so?"
"You know."
I rock my head side to side, nestling my neck against his palm.
"Just..."
I trail off, too contented to go on. His fingers scratch in and out against my skin, tugging lightly on my hair, and I sigh with pleasure as I sink against him, my hand settling on his chest as my forehead rests against his. He sets his hand on mine, and I lace my fingers into it as I tip my face up to his, our noses grazing. His chin lifts, fingers graze my jaw. Next thing I know, he's kissing me. I'm kissing Alex Nilsson. A warm, slow drink of a kiss. Both of us are almost laughing at first, like this whole thing is a very funny joke. Then his tongue sweeps over my bottom lip, a brush of fiery heat. His teeth catch it briefly next, and there's no more laughing. My hands slip into his hair, and he pulls me across his lap, his hands running up my back and down again to squeeze my hips. My breaths are shuddering and quick as his mouth teases mine open again, his tongue sweeping deeper, his taste sweet and clean and intoxicating. We're frantic hands and sharp teeth, fabric peeled away from skin and fingernails digging into muscles. Probably Bernard is still snoring, but I can't hear him over Alex's deliciously shallow breath or his voice in my ear saying my name like a swear word or my heartbeat raging through my eardrums as I rock my hips against his. All those things we didn't get to say no longer matter because really, this is what we needed. I need more of him. I reach for his belt. Because he's wearing a belt, of course he's wearing a belt, but he catches my wrist and draws back, his lips bee-stung and hair mussed, all of him rumpled in a completely unfamiliar and extremely appealing way.
"We can't do this,"
he says, voice thick.
"We can't?"
Stopping feels like running into a wall, like there are little cartoon birds twirling dazedly around my head as I try to make sense of what he's saying.
"We shouldn't," Alex amends. "We're drunk."
"Not too drunk to make out, but too drunk to sleep together?"
I say, almost laughing from the absurdity or from the disappointment. Alex's mouth twists.
"No," he says. "I mean, it shouldn't have happened at all. We've both been drinking, and we're not thinking clearly.
Mm-hmm.
I scoot away from him, smoothing my pajama shirt back down. My embarrassment is the total body kind, a gut punch that makes my eyes water. I shove myself off the floor, Alex following my lead.
You're right, I say. It was a bad idea.
Alex looks miserable.
I just mean...
I get it, I say quickly, trying to patch the hole before the boat can take on more water. It was a mistake to go there, to risk this. But I need to convince him everything's fine, that we didn't just pour gasoline onto our friendship and light a match.
Let's not make this a big deal. It's not,
I go on, my conviction building.
It's like you said, we each had like 3 bottles of wine. We weren't thinking clearly. We'll pretend it never happened, okay?
He stares at me hard, a tense expression I can't quite read.
You think you can do that?
Alex, of course, I say. We've got way more history than just one drunken night.
Okay.
He nods.
Okay.
After a beat of silence, he says,
I should get to bed.
He studies me for another beat, then mumbles,
good night,
and slips out the door. After a few minutes of mortified pacing, I drag myself to bed, where every time I start drifting off, the whole encounter plays over in my mind. The unbearable excitement of kissing him, and the even more unbearable humiliation of our conversation. In the morning, when I wake, there's one blissful moment when I think I dreamed the whole thing. Then I stumble to the bathroom mirror and see a good old-fashioned hickey on my neck, and the cycle of memories starts anew. I decide not to bring it up when I see him. The best thing I can do is pretend to truly have forgotten what happened, to prove I'm okay and nothing has to change between us. When we get to the airport, Bernard, Alex, and I, and Bernard wanders off to use the bathroom, we have our first minute alone of the day. Alex coughs.
I'm sorry about last night. I know I started it all, and it shouldn't have happened like that.
Seriously, I say, it's not a big deal.
I know you're not over Trey, he murmurs, looking away. I shouldn't have.
Would it make things better or worse to admit how little Trey crossed my mind for weeks before this trip? That last night, I hadn't been thinking about anyone but Alex.
It's not your fault, I promise. We both let it happen, and it doesn't have to mean anything, Alex. We're just 2 friends who kissed once while drunk.
He studies me for a few seconds.
All right.
He doesn't look like he's all right. He looks like he'd rather be at a saxophone convention with any number of serial killers right now. My heart squeezes painfully.
So we're good? I say, willing it to be so.
Bernard reappears then with a story about a heavily toilet-papered airport bathroom he once visited on the Sunday of Mother's Day, for those who want the exact date, and Alex and I barely look at each other. When I get home, something keeps me from texting him. He'll text me, I think. Then I'll know we're okay. After a week of silence, I send him a casual text about a funny t-shirt I see on the subway, and he writes back, ha, but nothing else. 2 weeks later, when I ask, are you okay? He just replies, sorry, been really busy. You okay? For sure, I say. Alex stays busy. I get busy too, and that's it. I always knew there was a reason we kept a boundary up. We'd let our libidos get the best of us, and now he couldn't even look at me, text me back. 10 years of friendship flushed down the drain, just so I could know what Alex Nilsson tastes like. 34. This summer. I can't stop thinking about that first kiss. Not our first kiss on Nikolai's balcony, but the one 2 years ago in Croatia. All this time, that memory has looked one way in my mind, but now it looks entirely different. I'd thought he regretted what happened. Now I understood he regretted how it happened.
on a drunk whim, when he couldn't be sure of my intentions, when I wasn't sure of my intentions. He'd been afraid it hadn't meant anything, and then I'd pretended it hadn't. All this time, I'd thought he'd rejected me, and he'd thought I'd been cavalier with him and his heart. It made me ache to think of how I'd hurt him, and worst of all, maybe he was right. Because even if that kiss hadn't meant nothing to me, I also hadn't thought it through. Not the first time, and not this time either. Not like Alex had. "Poppy," Swapna says, leaning around my cubicle. "Do you have a moment?" I've been at my desk, staring at this website for tourism in Siberia for upwards of 45 minutes. Turns out Siberia is actually sort of beautiful. Perfect for a self-imposed exile if one should have need of such a thing. I minimize the site. Sure. Swapna glances over her shoulder, checking who else is in today, parked at their desks. "Actually, are you up for a walk?" It's been 2 weeks since I got back from Palm Springs, and it's technically too early for fall weather, but we've got a random pop of it today in New York. Swapna grabs her Burberry trench, and I grab my vintage herringbone one, and we set off toward the coffee shop on the corner. "So," she says, "I can't help but notice you've been in a funk." "Oh, I thought I'd been doing an okay job hiding how I was feeling. For one thing, I've been exercising for like 4 hours a night, which means I sleep like a baby, wake up still exhausted, and trudge through my days without too much brain power left for wondering when Alex might answer one of my phone calls or call me back. Or why this job feels as tiring as bartending back in Ohio did. I can't make anything add up how it should anymore. All day long, I hear myself saying this same phrase, like I'm desperate to get it out of my body, even as I feel incapable. I am having a hard time." As mild as that statement is, every bit as mild as "I can't help but notice you've been in a funk," it sears to my center every time I hear it. "I am having a hard time," I think desperately 1,000 times a day. And when I try to probe for more information, "A hard time with what?" the voice replies, "Everything." I feel insufficient as an adult. I look around at the office and see everyone typing, taking calls, making bookings, editing documents, and I know they're all dealing with at least as much as I am, which only makes me feel worse about how hard everything feels to me. Living, being responsible for myself, seems like an insurmountable challenge lately. Sometimes I scrape myself off my sofa, stuff a frozen meal in the microwave, and as I wait for the timer to go off, I just think, I will have to do this again tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day. Every day for the rest of my life, I'm going to have to figure out what to eat and make it for myself, no matter how bad I feel or tired I am, or how horrible the pounding in my head is. Even if I have a 102-degree fever, I will have to pull myself up and make a very mediocre meal to go on living. I don't say any of this to Swapna because, A, she's my boss, B, I don't know if I could translate any of these thoughts into spoken words, and C, even if I could, it would be humiliating to admit that I feel exactly like that incapable, lost, melancholy stereotype of a millennial that the world is so fond of raging against. "I guess I have been in a little bit of a funk," is what I say. "I didn't realize it was affecting my work. I'll do better." Swapna stops walking, turns on her towering Louboutins, and frowns. "It's not only about the work, Poppy. I have personally invested in mentoring you." "I know," I say. "You're an amazing boss, and I feel so lucky." "It's not about that either," Swapna says, the slightest bit impatient. "What I'm saying is that of course you're not obligated to talk to me about what's going on, but I do think it would help if you spoke with someone. Working toward your goals can be very lonely, and professional burnout is always a challenge. I've been there, trust me." I shift anxiously on my feet. While Swapna has been a mentor to me, we've never veered toward anything personal, and I'm unsure how much to say. "I don't know what's going on with me," I admit. I know my heart is broken at the thought of not having Alex in my life. I know that I wish I could see him every single day, and there's no part of me that's imagining what else could be out there, who I might miss out on knowing and loving if we were to really be together. I know that the thought of a life in Linfield terrifies the hell out of me. I know I worked so hard to be this person, independent, well-traveled, successful, and I don't know who I am if I let that go. I know that there's still no other job out there calling to me, the obvious answer to my unhappiness, and that this one, which has been amazing for a good portion of the last 4.5 years, lately has only left me tired. And all of that adds up to having no fucking clue where I go next, and thus no real right to call Alex, which is why I've finally stopped trying for the time being. Professional burnout, I say aloud. That's a thing that passes, right? Swapna smiles. For me, so far it always has. She reaches into her pocket and pulls out a little white business card. But like I said, it helps to speak with someone. I accept the card, and she tips her chin toward the coffee shop. Why don't you take a few minutes to yourself? Sometimes a change of scenery is all that's needed to get a little perspective. A change of scenery, I think, as she starts back the way we came. That used to work. I look down at the business card in my hand and can't help but laugh. Dr. Sandra Crone, psychologist. I pull out my phone and text Rachel. Is Dr. Mom accepting new patients? Is the current Pope wildly transgressive? She texts back. Rachel's mother has a home office in her brownstone in Brooklyn. While Rachel's own design aesthetic is airy and light, her mother's decor is warm and cozy, all dark wood and stained glass, hanging leafy plants and books piled high on every surface, wind chimes twinkling outside almost every window. In a way, it reminds me of being at home, although Dr. Crone's artsy, cultivated version of maximalism is a far cry from Mom and Dad's museum to our childhood. During the first session, I tell her I need help figuring out what comes next for me, but she recommends we start with the past instead. There's not much to say, I tell her. Then proceed to talk for 56 minutes straight, about my parents, about school, about the first trip home with Guillermo. She's the only person I've shared any of this with, aside from Alex, and while it feels good to get it out, I'm not sure how it's helping with my life-exploding crisis. Rachel makes me promise to stick with it for at least a couple months. Don't run from this, she says. You won't be doing yourself any favors. I know she's right. I have to run through, not away. My only hope for figuring this out is to stay, sit in the discomfort. In my weekly therapy sessions, in my job at R&R, in my mostly empty apartment. My blog sits unused, but I start to journal. My work trips are limited to regional weekend getaways, and during my downtime, I scour the internet for self-help books and articles, looking for something that speaks to me, like that $21,000 bear statue definitely did not. Sometimes I look for jobs in New York. Other times, I check listings near Linfield. I buy myself a plant, a book about plants, and a small loom. I try to teach myself how to weave with YouTube videos and realize within 3 hours that I'm as bored by it as I am bad at it. Still, I let the half-finished weaving sit out on my table for days, and it feels like proof that I live here. I have a life, here, a place that's mine. On the last day of September, I'm on my way to meet Rachel at the wine bar when my bag gets caught in the subway doors of a crowded train car. Shit, 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 I hiss, while on the other side a few people work to pry them open. A balding but youngish man in a blue suit manages to get the doors apart, and when I look up to thank him, recognition flashes clear and sharp across his blue eyes. Poppy? He says, pushing the doors a little further apart. Poppy, right? I'm too stunned to reply.
He steps out of the train car, despite having made no effort to get out the first time the doors opened. This isn't his stop, but he's getting out, and I have to step back to make room for him as the doors snap closed again. And then we're standing there on the platform, and I should say something. I know I have to. He got off the freaking train. I manage only, "Wow, Jason." He nods, grinning, touching his chest where a light pink tie hangs from the pressed collar of his white shirt. "Jason Stanley, East Linfield High School." My brain is still trying to process this. It can't reconcile him against this backdrop. In my city, in the life I built to never touch my old one. I stammer, "Right." Jason Stanley has lost most of his hair. He's put on some weight around the middle, but there's still something of the cute boy I once had a crush on, who then ruined my life. He laughs, elbows me. "You were my first girlfriend." "Well," I say, because that doesn't seem quite right. I've never thought of Jason Stanley as my first boyfriend. First crush turned bully, maybe. "Are you busy right now?" He glances at his watch. "I've got a few minutes if you want to catch up." I do not want to catch up. "I'm actually on my way to therapy," I say, for some fucking reason. It was the first excuse that came to mind. I'd prefer to have blurted out that I was taking a metal detector to the nearest beach to look for quarters. I stride toward the steps, and Jason follows along. "Therapy," he says, still grinning. "Not because of that shit I pulled when I was a jealous little prick, I hope." He winks. "I mean, you hope to make an impression, just not that sort."
"I don't know what you're talking about," I lie as we climb the steps.
"Really?" Jason says. "God, that's a relief. I think about it all the time. Even tried to look you up on Facebook once so I could apologize. You don't have Facebook, do you?"
"Not really, no," I say. "I do have Facebook. I do not have my last name on Facebook, specifically because I didn't want people like Jason Stanley finding me, or anyone from Linfield. I wanted to vanish that part of me and reappear fully formed in a new city, and that's what I did."
We emerge from the subway onto the tree-lined streets. That same nip is back in the air. Fall has finally swallowed up the last bites of summer.
"Anyway," Jason says, the first signs of embarrassment kicking in. He stops, rubbing the back of his head. "I'll leave you alone. I saw you and I couldn't believe it. I just wanted to say hi. And sorry, I guess."
But I stop too. Because haven't I been saying for a month that I'm done running from problems, damn it? I left Linfield, and somehow that wasn't enough. He's here, like the universe is giving me a hard shove in the right direction. I take a breath and wheel toward him, crossing my arms. "Sorry for what, Jason?" He must see it in my face, that I was lying about not remembering, because he looks hugely embarrassed now. He takes a stiff, stuttering breath, studies his brown dress shoes guiltily.
"You remember how awful middle school was, right?" he says. "You feel so out of place, like something's wrong with you, and any second everyone else is gonna figure it out. You see it happen to other people. Kids you used to play foursquare with suddenly getting mean nicknames, not getting invited to birthday parties, and you know you could be next. So you turn into a little asshole. If you point at other people, no one will look too closely at you, right? I was your asshole. I mean, I was the asshole in your life for a while."
The sidewalk sways in front of me, a wave of dizziness crashing over me. Whatever I was expecting, that wasn't it.
"I honestly can't believe I'm even saying this," he says. "I just saw you on that train platform, and I had to say something."
Jason takes a deep breath, his frown drawing tired wrinkles at the corners of his mouth and eyes. We're so old, I think. When did we get so old? Suddenly, we're not kids anymore,
and it feels like it happened overnight, so fast I didn't have time to notice, to let go of everything that used to matter so much, to see that the old wounds that once felt like gut-level lacerations have faded to small white scars, mixed in among the stretch marks and sunspots and little divots where time has grazed against my body. I've put so much time and distance between myself and that lonely girl, and what does it matter? Here is a piece of my past right in front of me, miles away from home. You can't outrun yourself. Not your history, not your fears, not the parts of yourself you're worried are wrong. Jason darts another glance at his feet.
At the reunion, he says, someone told me you were doing great. Working at R&R, that's amazing. I actually, grabbed an issue a while back and read your articles. It's so cool. Seems like you've seen the whole world.
Finally, I manage to speak.
Yeah, it's really cool.
His smile widens.
And you live here?
Mm-hmm. I cough to clear my throat. What about you?
Nah, he says. I'm on business. Sales stuff. I'm still back in Linfield.
This, I realize, is what I've been waiting for years. The moment when I finally know I've won. I got out. I made something of myself. I found a place I belonged. I proved I wasn't broken while the person who was cruelest to me stayed stuck in crappy little Linfield. Except that's not how I feel. Because Jason doesn't seem stuck, and he certainly isn't being cruel. He's here, in this city, in a nice white shirt, being genuinely kind. There's a stinging in my eyes, a hot feeling in the back of my throat.
If you're ever back there, Jason says uncertainly, and you want to meet up.
I try to make some kind of noise as assent, but nothing happens. It's like the tiny person who sits at the control panel in my brain has just passed out.
So, Jason goes on, sorry again. I hope you know it was always about me, not you.
The sidewalk swings again, a pendulum. Like the world as I've always seen it has been jostled so hard it's rocking, might come crashing down entirely. Obviously, people grow up, a voice says in my head. You think all those people were just frozen in time just because they stayed in Linfield? But like he said, it's not about them, it's about me. That's exactly what I thought. That if I didn't get out, I'd always be that lonely girl. I would never belong anywhere.
So if you're in Linfield, he says again.
But you're not hitting on me, right? I say.
Oh, God, no.
Now he holds up his hand, showing off one of those thick black bands on his ring finger.
Married, happily, monogamously.
Cool, I say, because it's really the only English word I remember at present. Which is saying something, since I don't speak any other languages.
Yep, he says. Well, see ya.
And then Jason Stanley's gone, as suddenly as he appeared. By the time I get to the wine bar, I've started to cry. What's new? When Rachel jumps up from our usual table, she looks stricken at the sight of me.
Are you okay, babe? I'm going to quit my job, I say tearily.
Oh, okay?
I mean,
I sniff hard, wipe at my eyes.
Not immediately, like in a movie. I'm not going to walk into Swapna's office and be like, I quit, and then walk straight out of the office in a tight red dress with my hair down my back or anything.
Well, that's good. Orange is better for your complexion.
Either way, I have to find another job before I can leave, I say. But I think I just figured out why I've been so unhappy.
35. This summer. If you need me, Rachel says, I'll go with you. I mean, I seriously will. I'll buy a ticket on the way to the airport and I'll go with you. Even as she says it, she looks like I'm holding out a giant cobra with human blood dripping off its teeth. I know. I squeeze her hand.
But then who will keep us up to date on everything happening in New York?
Oh, thank God, she says in a gust. I was afraid you'd take me up on that for a minute.
She pulls me into a hug, kisses me on either cheek, and puts me into the cab. My parents both come to pick me up from the Cincinnati airport. They're wearing matching I Heart Symbol New York t-shirts.
Thought it would make you feel at home,
Mom says, laughing so hard at her joke that she's practically crying. I think it might be the first time she or Dad has acknowledged New York as my home, which makes me happy on one level and sad on another. I already feel at home here, I tell her, and she makes a big show of clutching her heart, and a squeak of emotion sneaks out of her.
By the way, she says as we bustle across the parking lot, I made Buckeye cookies.
So that's dinner, but what about breakfast? I ask. She titters. No one on the planet thinks I'm as funny as my mom does. It's like taking candy from a baby, or giving candy to a baby.
So, buddy,
Dad says once we're in the car,
to what do we owe this honor? It's not even a bank holiday.
I just missed you guys, I say. And Alex.
Shoot,
Dad grunts, putting on his turn signal.
Now you're gonna make me cry.
We go home first so I can change out of my plain clothes, give myself a pep talk, and bide my time. School's not out until 2:30. Until then, the three of us sit on the porch, drinking homemade lemonade. Mom and Dad take turns talking about their plans for the garden next year. What all they'll be pulling up, what new flowers and trees they'll plant. The fact that Mom is trying to Marie Kondo the house, but has only managed to get rid of 3 shoeboxes worth of stuff so far.
Progress is progress,
Dad says, reaching out to rub her shoulder affectionately.
Have we told you about the privacy fence, buddy? The new next-door neighbor is a gossip, so we decided we needed a fence.
He comes by to tell me what everyone in this cul-de-sac is up to and doesn't have anything good to say,
Mom cries.
I'm sure he's saying the same kinds of things about us.
Oh, I doubt it, I say. Your lies will be much more colorful. This delights Mom, obviously. Candy, meet baby.
Once we get the fence up,
Dad says,
he'll tell everyone we're running a meth lab.
Oh, stop.
Mom smacks his arm, but they're both laughing.
We've got to video call with the boys later. Parker wants to do a reading of the new screenplay he's working on.
I narrowly avoid a spit take. The last screenplay my brother's been brainstorming in the group text is a gritty, dystopian Smurfs origin story with at least one sex scene. His reasoning is, someday he'd like to write a real movie, but by writing one that can't possibly get made, he's taking the pressure off himself during the learning process. Also, I think he enjoys scandalizing his family. At 2:15, I ask to take the car and head up to my old high school. Only at that point, I realize the tank's empty. After the quick detour for gas, I pull into the school's parking lot at 2:50. 2 separate anxieties are warring for domination inside me. The one that's composed of terror at the thought of seeing Alex, saying what I need to say, and hoping he'll hear it, and the one that's all about being back here, a place I legitimately swore I'd never waste another second in. I march up the concrete steps to the glass front doors, take one last deep breath, and the door doesn't budge. It's locked.
Right.
I sort of forgot that any random adult can't walk into a high school anymore. Definitely for the best, in every situation except this one. I knock on the door until a beaky resource officer with a halo of gray hair approaches and cracks the door a few inches.
Can I help you?
I'm here to see someone, I say. A teacher, Alex Nilsson?
Name?
He asks.
Alex Nilsson.
Your name,
the officer says, correcting me. Oh, Poppy Wright. He closes the door, disappearing for a second into the front office. A moment later, he returns.
Sorry, ma'am, we don't have you in our system. We can't let in unregistered guests.
Could you just get him then? I try.
Ma'am, I can't go track down.
Poppy? Someone says behind him.
Oh, wow, I think at first. Someone recognizes me. What luck!
And then the pretty, lean brunette steps up to the door. My stomach bottoms out.
Sarah. Wow. Hi.
I'd forgotten that I could potentially run into Sarah Torval here. Borderline monumental oversight. She glances back at the resource officer.
I've got it, Mark, she says, and steps outside to talk to me, folding her arms across herself.
She's wearing a cute purple dress and dark denim jacket, large silver earrings dancing from her ears. She has just a splash of freckles across her nose. As ever, she is completely adorable in that kindergarten teacher way, despite being a ninth grade teacher, of course.
What are you doing here?
She asks, not unkindly, though definitely not warmly.
Visiting my parents.
She arches a brow and glances at the red brick building behind her.
At the high school?
No. I push the hair out of my eyes. I mean, that's what I'm doing here. But what I'm doing here is, I wanted to talk to Alex. Her eye roll is minimal, but it stings. I swallow an apple-sized knot.
I deserve that, I say.
I take a breath. This won't be fun, but it's necessary. I was really careless about everything, Sarah. I mean, my friendship with Alex, everything I expected from him while you were together. It wasn't fair to you. I know that now.
Yeah, she says. You were careless about it.
We're both silent for a beat. Finally, she sighs.
We all made some bad decisions. I used to think that if you just went away, all my problems would be solved.
She uncrosses her arms and recrosses them the other way.
And then you did. You basically disappeared after we went to Tuscany, and somehow that was even worse for my relationship.
I sway from foot to foot.
I'm sorry. I wish I'd understood what I was feeling before it had a chance to hurt anyone.
She nods to herself, examines the perfectly painted toenails poking out of her tan leather sandals.
I wish so too, she says. Or that he had. Or that I had. Really, if any of us had really known how you two felt about each other, it would have saved me a lot of time and pain.
Yeah, I agree.
So you and he aren't...
She lets me wait for a few seconds, and I know it's not an accident. A semi-devilish smile curls up her pink lips.
We aren't, she relents. Thank God. But he's not here. He already left. I think he was talking about getting away for the weekend.
Oh. My heart sinks. I glance back at my parents' minivan parked in the half-empty lot.
Well, thanks anyway.
She nods, and I start down the steps.
Poppy?
I turn back, and the light's shining so bright on her that I have to shield my eyes to look at her. It makes her look like she's a saint, earning her halo by unwarranted kindness toward me. I'll take it, I think.
Usually on Fridays, she says slowly, teachers go to Birdie's. It's a tradition.
She moves, and the light lets up enough for me to meet her eyes.
If he hasn't left, he might be there.
Thanks, Sarah.
Please, she says. You're doing the world a favor by taking Alex Nelson off the market.
I laugh, but it's leaden in my stomach.
I'm not sure that's what he wants.
She shrugs.
Maybe not, she says. But most of us are too scared to even ask what we want in case we can't have it. Read that in this essay about something called millennial ennui.
I stifle a laugh of surprise, clear my throat.
Kind of a catchy name, right?
She says.
Anyway, good luck.
Birdie's is across the street from the school, and the 2-minute drive over is about 4 hours too short to formulate a new plan. The whole flight down, I practiced my impassioned speech with thought that it would be said in private, in his classroom. Now it's going to be in a bar full of teachers, including some whose classes I took, and skipped. If there's one place I have judged more harshly than the fluorescent-lit halls of East Linfield High School, it's the dark, cramped bar with the glowing neon Budweiser sign I'm entering right now. All at once, the light of day is shut out, and colorful dots dance in front of my eyes as they adjust to this dim place. There's a Rolling Stones song playing on the radio, and considering it's only 3 in the afternoon, the bar is already hopping with people in business casual, a sea of khakis and button-ups and cotton dresses in monochrome, not unlike Sarah's getup. Golf paraphernalia hangs on the walls, clubs and green astroturf and framed pictures of golfers and golf courses. I know there's a city in Illinois called Normal, but I'm guessing it doesn't hold a candle to this suburban corner of the universe. There are mounted TVs turned up too loud, a scratchy radio playing underneath that, bursts of laughter and raised voices coming from the groups crowded around high tops or lined up along either side of narrow rectangular tables. And then I see him. Taller than most, stiller than all, his shirt sleeves rolled to the elbows and boots resting on the metal rung of his chair, his shoulders hunched forward and his phone out, thumb slowly scrolling up his screen. My heart rises into my throat until I can taste it, all metallic and hot and pulsing too hard. There's a part of me, fine, a majority, that wants to bolt, even after flying all the way here. But right then, the door squeals open and Alex glances up, his eyes locking onto me. We're looking at each other, and I imagine I look nearly as shocked as he does, like I didn't arrive specifically on a hot tip that he was here. I force myself to take a few steps toward him, then stop at the end of the table, where, gradually, the other teachers look up from their beers and white wines and vodka tonics to process the fact of me. "Hi," Alex says, little more than a whisper. "Hi," I say. I wait for the rest to pour out. Nothing does. "Who's your friend?" an old lady in a maroon turtleneck asks. I clock her for Delallo, even before I see the ELHS name badge she's still wearing around her neck.
"She's..."
Alex's voice drops off. He stands from his chair. "Hi," he says again. The rest of the table are exchanging uncomfortable looks, kind of scooting their chairs in, angling their backs away in an attempt to give us a level of privacy that's impossible at this point. Delallo, I notice, keeps one ear tilted almost precisely toward us. "I came to the school," I manage.
"Oh,"
Alex says.
"Okay."
"I had this plan." I rub my sweaty palms against my orange polyester bell bottoms, wishing I wasn't dressed like a traffic cone. "I was going to show up to the school, because I wanted you to know that if there's one thing in this world that could get me to go there, it's you." His eyes briefly pass over the table of teachers again. So far, my speech doesn't seem to be comforting him. His eyes cut to mine, then drop to a vague point on my left.
"Yeah, I know you really hate it there," he murmurs.
"I do," I agree. "I have a lot of bad memories there, and I wanted to show up there and just, like, tell you that I would go anywhere for you, Alex."
"Poppy,"
he says, the word half sigh, half plea. "No, wait," I say. "I know I have a 50-50 chance here, and there's so much of me that wants to not even say the rest of this, Alex, but I need to. So please, don't tell me yet if you need to break my heart, okay? Let me say this before I lose the nerve." His lips part for a moment, his green-gold eyes like storm-flooded rivers, brutal and rushing. He presses his mouth closed again and nods. Feeling like I'm jumping off a cliff, unable to see what lies through the fog beneath me, I go on. "I loved running my blog," I tell him. "I loved it so much, and I thought it was because I loved traveling, which I do. But in the last few years, everything's changed. I wasn't happy. Traveling felt different. And maybe you were sort of right, that I came at you like you were a band-aid that could fix everything, or whatever, a fun destination to give me a dopamine rush and a new perspective. His eyes drop. He won't look at me, and I feel like even if he was the one who said it first, my confirmation is eating him alive. I started therapy, I blurt out, trying to keep things moving. And I was trying to figure out why it feels so different now, and I was listing all the differences between my life then and now, and it wasn't just you. I mean, you're the biggest one. You were on those trips, and then you weren't, but that wasn't the only change. All those trips we took, the best thing about them, other than doing it all with you, was the people. His gaze lifts, narrowed in thought. I loved meeting new people, I explain. I loved feeling connected, feeling interesting. Growing up here, I was so fucking lonely, and I always felt like there was something wrong with me, but I told myself if I went somewhere else, it would be different. There'd be other people like me.
I know that, he says. I know you hate it here, Poppy.
I did, I say. I hated it, so I escaped. And when Chicago didn't fix everything for me, I left there too. Once I started traveling, though, things finally felt better. I met people, and I don't know, without the baggage of history or the fear of what would happen, it felt so much easier to open up to people, to make friends. I know it sounds pathetic, but all those little chance encounters we had, those made me less lonely. Those made me feel like I was someone people could love. And then I got the R&R job, and the trips changed. The people changed. I only met chefs and hotel managers, people wanting write-ups. I'd go on amazing trips, but I'd come home feeling empty. And now I realize it's because I wasn't connecting to anyone.
I'm glad you figured it out, Alex says. I want you to be happy.
But here's the thing, I say. Even if I quit my job and started taking the blog seriously again, went back to meeting all the Bucks and Litas and Matildes of the world, it's not going to make me happy. I needed those people because I felt alone. I thought I had to run hundreds of miles away from here to find some place to belong. I spent my whole life thinking anyone outside my family who got too close, saw too much, wouldn't want me anymore. The safest thing was those quick, serendipitous moments with strangers. That's all I thought I could have. And then there was you. My voice wobbles dangerously. I steel myself, straighten my spine. I love you so much that I've spent 12 years putting as much distance between us as I could. I moved. I traveled. I dated other people. I talked about Sarah all the fucking time because I knew you had a crush on her and it felt safer that way. Because the last person I could take being rejected by was you. And now I know that. I know it's not traveling that's going to get me out of this slump, and it's not a new job, and it's sure as hell not chance encounters with water taxi drivers. All of that, every minute of it, has been running away from you, and I don't want to do that anymore. I love you, Alex Nilsson. Even if you don't give me a real chance, I'm always going to love you. And I'm scared to move back to Linfield because I don't know if I'd like it here, or if I'd be bored, or if I'd make any friends, and because I'm terrified to run into the people who made me feel like I didn't matter, and for them to decide they were right about me. I want to stay in New York, I say. I like it there, and I think you would too, but you asked me what I'd be willing to give up for you, and now I know the answer is everything. There's nothing in this whole world that I've built in my head that I'm not prepared to let go of to build a new one with you. I'll go into East Linfield High. I don't just mean today. I mean if you want me to stay here, I'll go to fucking high school basketball games with you. I'll wear hand-painted t-shirts with players' names on them. I'll learn the players' names. I won't just make them up. I'll go to your dad's house and drink diet soda and try my hardest not to cuss or talk about our sex life, and I'll babysit your nieces and nephew with you in Betty's house. I'll help you take down wallpaper. I hate taking down wallpaper. You're not a vacation, and you're not the answer to my career crisis, but when I'm in a crisis, or I'm sick, or I'm sad, you're the only thing I want. And when I'm happy, you make me so much happier.
I still have a lot to figure out, but the one thing I know is, wherever you are, that's where I belong. I'll never belong anywhere like I belong with you. No matter what I'm feeling, I want you next to me. You're home to me, Alex, and I think I'm that for you too.
By the time I finish, I'm breathing hard. Alex's face is torqued with worry, but beyond that, I can't read too many specifics. He doesn't say anything right away, and the silence, or lack of it, Pink Floyd has started to play over the speakers and a sports announcer is jabbering on one of the TVs overhead, unfurls like a rug, stretching longer and longer between us until I feel like I'm on the opposite side of a very dark, beer-sticky mansion.
And one more thing.
I fish my phone out of my bag, open to the correct photo, and hold it out to him. He doesn't take the phone, just looks at the image on screen without touching.
What's this?
He says softly.
That, I say, is a houseplant I've kept alive since I got back from Palm Springs.
A quiet laugh leaks out of him. It's a snake plant, I say. And apparently they're extremely hard to kill. Like, I could probably take a chainsaw to it and it would survive, but it's the longest I've kept anything alive and I wanted you to see it. So you'd know. I'm serious. He nods without saying anything, and I tuck my phone back into my bag.
That's it, I say, a little bewildered. That's the whole speech. You can talk now.
The corner of his mouth quirks, but the smile doesn't stay. And even while it's there, it holds nothing like mirth in its tight curve.
Poppy.
My name has never sounded quite so long or miserable.
Alex, I say.
His hands go to his hips. He glances sidelong, though there's nothing there to look at, except an astroturf wall and a faded photo of someone in a pom-pom-topped golf hat. When he looks back at me, there are tears in his eyes, but I know right away he won't let them fall. That's the kind of self-restraint Alex Nilsson has. He could be starving in a desert, and if the wrong person held out a glass of water to him, he'd nod politely and say, "No thanks." I swallow the goiter in my throat.
You can say anything, whatever you need to.
He lets out a breath, checks the floor, meets my eyes for barely an instant.
You know how I feel about you,
he says softly. Like even as he admits it, it's still a sort of secret.
Yes.
My heart has started racing. I think I do. At least I did. But I know how much I hurt him by not thinking through things. I don't totally understand it, maybe, but I've barely started to understand myself, so that's not all that surprising. He swallows now, the muscles down the line of his jaw dancing with shadows.
I honestly don't know what to say, he replies. You terrified me. It doesn't make any sense how quick my mind works with you. One second we're kissing, and the next I'm thinking about what our grandkids might be named. It doesn't make sense. I mean, look at us. We don't make sense. We've always known that, Poppy.
My heart is icing over, veins of cold working their way into its center, splitting it in half and me with it. Now it's my turn to say his name like a plea, like a prayer.
Alex.
It comes out thick.
I don't know what you're saying.
His eyes drop, his teeth worrying over his bottom lip.
I don't want you to give anything up, he says. I want us to just make sense. And we don't, Poppy. I can't watch it fall apart again.
I'm nodding now, for a long time. It's like I can't stop accepting it over and over again. Because this is what it feels like. Like I'll have to spend the rest of my life accepting that Alex can't love me the way I love him.
Okay,
I whisper. He says nothing.
Okay.
One more time. I tear my eyes from him as I feel the tears encroaching. I don't want to make him comfort me, not for this.
I turn and barrel toward the door, forcing my feet forward, keeping my chin high and my backbone straight. When I make it to the door, I can't help myself. I look back. Alex is still frozen where I left him. And even if it kills me, I have to be honest right now. I have to say something I can't take back, to stop running and hiding myself from him. I don't regret telling you, I say. I said I'd give anything up, risk anything for you. And I meant it. Even my own heart. I love you all the way, Alex, I say. I couldn't have lived with myself if I hadn't at least told you. And then I turn and step out into the brightly shining sun of the parking lot. Only then do I really start to cry. 36. This summer. I'm heaving, wheezing, splintering as I cross the parking lot. One hand clamped over my mouth as sobs snap through me, slice and stab in every sharp little corner of my lungs. It's both hard to keep moving and impossible to stop. I'm power walking to my parents' car, then leaning against it, head bowed, horrible sounds coming out of me, snot dripping down my face, the blue of the sky and its fluffy cumulus clouds and the rustling trees alongside the parking lot all turning into a summery blur, the whole world melting into a swirl of color. And then there's a voice, spread thin by the breeze and the distance. It's coming from behind me. Obviously, it's his, and I don't want to look. I think one more look at him might be the tipping point, the thing that breaks my heart forever. But he's saying my name.
Poppy!
Once, then again.
Poppy, wait!
I shove all the emotions down. Not to ignore them, not to deny them, because it almost feels good to feel something so purely, to know without question what it is my body's experiencing, but because these are my feelings, not his, not something for him to swoop in and shoulder like he does almost compulsively. I wipe my hands across my face and make myself breathe normally as I listen to his steps scuffing over asphalt. I turn as he's slowing from a jog, taking his last steps at a determined but casual pace until he stops, closing me in between the van and himself. There's a lull before he speaks, a pause that's just for our breathing. After another second of silence, he says,
I started seeing a therapist too.
Despite myself, I give a phlegmy laugh at the idea that he's chased me down just to say this.
That's good.
I wipe at my face with the heel of my hand.
She says,
he rakes his hands through his hair.
She thinks I'm afraid to be happy.
Why is he telling me this? One voice says in my head. I hope he never stops talking, another says. Maybe we can keep talking forever. Maybe this conversation can span our entire lives, the way our text messages and phone calls seemed to for all those years. I clear my throat.
Are you?
He looks at me for a long moment, then gives the smallest shake of his head.
No,
he says.
I know if I got on a plane with you back to New York, I would be so fucking happy. For as long as you'd have me, I'd be happy.
Again, that kaleidoscopic swirl of colors blurs across my vision. I blink the tears back.
And I want that so badly. I do regret every chance I missed to tell you how I felt. All the times I convinced myself I'd lose you if you really knew, or that we were too different. I want to just be happy with you, but I'm afraid of what comes after.
His voice cracks.
I'm afraid of you realizing I bore you, or meeting someone else, or being unhappy and staying, and...
His voice catches.
I'm afraid of loving you for our entire lives and then having to say goodbye. I'm afraid of you dying and the world feeling useless. I'm afraid I won't be able to keep getting out of bed if you're gone. And if we had kids, they'd have these horrible lives where their amazing mom is gone and their dad can't look at them.
His hand passes over his eyes, catching some of the moisture there. Alex, I whisper. I don't know how to comfort him. I can't take any of his past pain away or promise it won't happen again. All I can do is tell him the truth, as I've seen it, as I know it. You already went through that. You lost someone you loved, and you kept getting out of bed. You were there for the people in your life, and you love them, and they love you back. You've got all of that in your life still. None of it went away. It didn't end just because you lost one person.
I know, he says. I'm just...
His voice draws taut, and his huge shoulders shrug.
Scared.
I reach out for his hands instinctively, and he lets me draw him closer, folding his fingers up between my palms. Then we've found something else to agree on, besides hating it when people call boats she, I whisper. It's fucking terrifying to be in love with each other. He sniffs through a laugh, cups my jaw in his hands, and presses his forehead against mine, his eyes closing as his breath sinks with mine, our chests rising and falling like we're two waves in the same body of water.
I never want to live without this,
he whispers, and I knot my fists into his shirt as if to keep him from slipping through my fingers. The corners of his mouth twist as he breathes out,
Tiny fighter.
His eyes slid open, and the flutter in my chest is so strong it almost hurts. I love him so much. I love him more than I did yesterday, and I already know tomorrow I'll love him even more, because every piece of him he gives me is another to fall in love with. He locks his arms tight around my back, his damp eyes so clear and open, I feel like I could dive into him, swim through his thoughts, float in the brain I love more than any other on the planet. His hands move into my hair, smoothing it against my neck, his eyes moving back and forth over my face with such beautifully calm, Alexian purpose.
You are, you know.
A fighter? I say,
my home, he says, and kisses me.
We are, I think. We're home.
Epilogue. We take a bus tour of the city. We wear our matching I Heart New York sweatshirts and bedazzled Big Apple hats. We carry a pair of binoculars and use them to lock on to anyone who bears even a passing resemblance to a celebrity. So far, we've spotted Dame Judi Dench, Denzel Washington, and young Jimmy Stewart. Our tour includes ferry passage to the Statue of Liberty, and when we get there, we ask a middle-aged woman to take our picture in front of the base, sun in our eyes and wind in our faces. She sweetly asks, "Where y'all from?" "Here," Alex says, at the same time I say, "Ohio." Halfway through the tour, we skip out and go to Cafe Lalo instead, determined to sit just where Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks did in You've Got Mail. It's cold out, and the city looks its best for us, springy pink and white blossoms skittering across the streets as we sip our cappuccinos. He's been here full-time for 5 months now, since the fall semester ended, and he found a long-term substitute position here for the spring one. I didn't know regular life could feel like this, like a vacation you don't have to go home from. Of course, it's not always like this. Most weekends, Alex is tied up with working on his own writing or grading papers and planning lessons, and on weekdays, I only see him long enough for a groggy morning kiss. I sometimes fall back to sleep so fast I don't even remember it happening, and there's laundry and dirty dishes, which Alex insists we wash immediately after dinner, and taxes and dentist appointments and lost Metro cards. But there are also discoveries. New parts of the man I love introduced to me daily. For example, It turns out Alex can't fall asleep if we're spooning. He has to be wholly on his side of the bed, me on mine, until the middle of the night, at which point I wake up overheated with his limbs flung over me and have to shove him off so I can cool down. It's incredibly annoying, but the second I'm comfortable again, I find myself smiling in the dark, feeling so unbelievably lucky to sleep every night beside my favorite person in the world. Even being uncomfortably warm is better with him. Sometimes we put on music in the kitchen while he's cooking, and we dance. Not a sweet, swaying embrace like we're in some romantic movie, but ridiculous writhing, twirling until we're dizzy, laughing until we're snorting or crying. Sometimes we catch each other on camera and text the video to David and Tom, or Parker and Prince. My brothers send back their own kitchen dancing videos. David replies with some variation of, "Love you, freaks," or, "Apparently there's someone for everyone." We're happy, and even when we're not, it's so much better than it was without him. The last stop of our night playing tourist is Times Square. We saved the worst for last, but it's a rite of passage, and Alex insists he wants to go.
"If you can still love me there," he says, "I'll know this is real."
"Alex," I say, "if I can't love you at Times Square, then I don't deserve you in a used bookstore." He slips his hand through mine as we're coming out of the subway station. I think it has less to do with affection, public displays of which he's still not wild about, and more to do with a genuine fear of getting separated in the ridiculous crowd we're moving toward. We last in the square, surrounded by flashing lights and street performers painted silver and jostling tourists, for all of 3 minutes, just long enough to get some unflattering selfies of us looking overwhelmed. Then we do an about-face and march right back to the train platform. Back at the apartment, our apartment, Alex kicks off his shoes, then arranges them perfectly on the mat. We have a mat. We are adults. Next to mine. I've got an article to finish writing in the morning, my first for my new job. I was dreading telling Swapna I was leaving, but she wasn't mad. In fact, she hugged me. It felt like being hugged by Beyonce. And later that night, a huge bottle of champagne was delivered to my and Alex's door. "Congratulations on your column, Poppy," the note read. "I've always known you were going places. X. Swapna." The irony of it all is, I won't be going places anymore, at least not for work. In a lot of other ways, though, my job won't be all that different. I'll still be going to restaurants and bars, writing about the new galleries and ice pop stands springing up around New York. But people you meet in New York will be different, too. More human interest piece than review. I'll be exploring my own city, but through the eyes of the people who love it, spending a day with someone in their favorite new spot, learning what makes it so special. My first piece is about a new bowling alley in Brooklyn with an old-school feel. Alex went with me to scope the place out, and I knew as soon as I spotted Dolores in the next lane over, personalized gold ball and matching gloves and a halo of frizzy gray hair, that she was someone who could teach me things. A bucket of beer, a long conversation, and a bowling lesson later, and I had everything I needed for the article. But Alex and Dolores and I walked over to the hot dog place down the street anyway, hung out until nearly midnight. The article's almost done, just needs a few finishing touches, but those can wait until the morning. I'm wiped out from our long day, and all I want to do is sink onto the couch with Alex.
"It's good to be home," he says, looping his arms around my back and pulling me flush to him.
I slip my hands up the back of his shirt and kiss him like I've been waiting to all day.
"Home," I say, "is my favorite place."
"Mine too," he murmurs, easing me back against the wall.
Next summer, we will get away from the city. We will spend 4 days tromping around Norway, another 4 in Sweden. There will be no ice hotel.
He's a teacher, I'm a writer, and we're both millennials. There's no money for that.
I'll leave a key for Rachel to water our plants, and after Sweden, we'll fly straight back to Linfield for the rest of Alex's summer break. We'll stay in Betty's house while he fixes it up, and I sit on the floor, eating Twizzlers and finding new ways to make him blush. We'll tear down wallpaper and choose new paint colors. We'll drink diet soda at dinner with his dad and brothers and the nieces and nephew. We'll sit on the porch with my parents, looking out over the wasteland of Wright family cars past. We'll try on our hometown the same way we've been trying on New York together. We'll see how it fits, where we want to be. But I already know how I'll feel. Wherever he is, that will be my favorite place.
What? He asks, the start of a smile tugging at his lips. Why are you staring?
You're just... I shake my head, searching for any word that could possibly encompass what I'm feeling. So tall. His smile is wide, unfettered, naked Alex just for me.
I love you too, Poppy Wright.
Tomorrow, we will love each other a little more, and the next day, and the next day. And even on those days when one or both of us is having a hard time, we'll be here, where we are completely known, completely accepted by the person whose every side we love wholeheartedly. I'm here with all the versions of him I've met over 12 years of vacations. And even if the point of life isn't just being happy, right now, I am. Down to the bones.
This is Julia Whalen. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of People We Meet on Vacation by Emily Henry. This program was produced by Kelly Gilday. Edited by BookTrack. Text copyright 2021 by Emily Henry. Production copyright 2021 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.